sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, a special conversation with the president of the American Medical Association, Dr. Jack Resnick Jr. The American Medical Association, otherwise known as AMA, is known as the voice of medicine in the United States. The AMA is the oldest and largest professional association and lobbying group of physicians and medical students. Founded in 1847, it's headquartered in Chicago, Illinois, with a membership of approximately 271,000 in 2021. The AMA's stated mission is to promote the art and science of medicine and the betterment of public health. The association also publishes the widely read and cited Journal of the American Medical Association, known as JAMA. Additionally, it publishes a list of physician specialty codes, which are the standard method in the United States for identifying physician and practice specialties. When our team found out that the current president of the AMA, Dr. Jack Resnick Jr., a dermatologist, would be in town for the Duval County Medical Society's Future of Healthcare Conference, we asked him to join us to discuss the current state of healthcare in the United States and what it might look like in the future. Dr. Resnick, welcome to our show and to our studios here in Jacksonville, Florida.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
It's so great to have you. So to all our listeners, I have to make a disclosure as I begin our conversation. I am a member of the American Medical Association and have been ever since I was a medical student, so I need to put that out there as we start our discussion today.
Great. Well, I appreciate your leadership.
It's wonderful, and I've always appreciated all that the AMA has done for me. But perhaps to our listeners who are not another medical professional, what exactly is the AMA and who are its members?
So we've been around for 175 years, and we really see ourselves as the voice of America's physicians. When we think about our mission, we talk about advancing the art and science of medicine and promoting the public health. So everything we do is ultimately about helping physicians who are our members take care of patients so that we can advance the health of the nation.
Do you have to be a physician to be a member? And the reason I ask that, there's such growth of the healthcare team, physician assistants, nurse practitioners. I'm just kind of curious how it fits into that.
Our members are all physicians, but we work closely with so many other groups in medicine. As you mentioned, sort of other members of the healthcare team that we collaborate with in policymaking around the country, patient groups. We'll really work with anybody, anytime, who shares our values and our policy goals to advance healthcare.
Got it. And again, to help those that are out there, how does one become a member?
So interestingly, we have individual memberships at AMA, and so there are over 250,000 physicians and medical students who actually join as individual members. But our policymaking process goes well beyond that. So we have this thing called the House of Delegates. It's sort of like our our Congress in a way where we make our policy, except we think it functions a little bit better than the U.S. Congress these days.
Yeah.
And so physicians from every state in the country representing state medical associations and physicians from every specialty group around the country gather a couple of times a year and actually have public open debate about what our policy on a wide variety of topics should be. And so when I go out and speak on behalf of the American Medical Association, it's not Jack Resnick's opinion necessarily or our board just deciding their opinion. I'm really speaking on behalf of a broad, the entirety really of the profession who gathers to have those policy debates.
Do you think that we still, that the AMA still captures a big proportion of the voices of physicians? Is there a big percentage of all doctors that are still joining the AMA and staying a part of the group?
Yeah, we certainly have physicians who choose to write that check and become individual members right. And others who don't. But I am pretty pleased. We've had 11 consecutive years of membership growth after many years in the past where it was sort of in general, I think across many professions, people were less likely to join their professional societies. So our membership is growing, which I think is a good sign. And I come back to that policymaking process that does give me great comfort that we're really representing the whole profession as we speak in public.
What does the AMA do for its members? And then we'll ask another question like that for the public in general, but for the members overall.
Well, I like to think that what we do, really everything is aligned both in terms of what we're doing for the public health and for our members. And I'm not even sure I can separate those lists. We have a broad organization with a lot of different areas. So people think of us for our advocacy, and that's definitely a big part of what we do. We have a large group in Washington that's focused on conversations that we have with Congress about important healthcare legislation. We have a group that works with the executive branch, so whether that's the FDA or HHS that oversees Medicare and Medicaid and other programs, engaging with them. We have a group that works on state legislation because so much of what gets decided in healthcare policy actually also happens at state levels. So every state has a physician society, and so the Florida Medical Association, for example, here in Florida, and we sort of have a federation model where we work closely with those state medical associations to advance our policy in states. We have a litigation center that at any given time has 60, 70, 80 ongoing cases, everything from small state courts and small regions about precedent-setting cases all the way up to Supreme Court cases that we're engaged in. We have a large group that focuses on medical education. We've had in our history a very big role in thinking about as time has passed, how we redesign medical education for physicians of the future and think about doing that right. Some people know us for our publishing arm, JAMA, mm-hmm. and the whole network of specialty journals under the JAMA umbrella, which is a big part of what we do. And then we have a lot of focus areas that we spend a lot of time and resources on, thinking about how we can do a better job as a country dealing with chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension and mental health diseases. We have a group focused on innovation, and we can talk about later, that really thinks about digital health and artificial intelligence and the next things that we're going to be implementing in healthcare and how to make sure we do it in a way that is actually helpful for patients and addresses needed gaps in care. We have a group that works on health equity when we see different groups around the country who don't have the same health outcomes as other groups. So I just touched the surface even with that big list. We're lucky to have the resources to be a large organization working on a lot of things that relate to health.
I love hearing that, and we're going to touch on a few of those topics as we move forward in our conversation here. Let me start with this. You know, as we hear left and right about how divided the United States is, and doctors are part of that mix. And I don't want to get into the politics of it, but we do have a lot of different mindsets, Republicans, Democrats, neither of those two. With so many physicians with varying views, this is more of an operational question, how does the AMA become the voice of American physicians and a voice of American medicine when there's so many disparate positions these days?
It's a really good question. And, you know, we are a nonpartisan organization. We, as I said earlier, sort of debate policy things using an evidence base and science when we have policy debates. And then we'll work with anybody, Republican, Democrat, you name it, anytime, who is aligned with us on an issue and willing to work to advance our policy and to advance health for our patients. You're right, though, that it has gotten a little bit harder. I would say many years ago, the vast majority of things that we worked on, our physicians or our members really didn't see through a partisan lens. And I think with some of the politicization around COVID and the pandemic and other things that have happened recently, some disinformation that we've been battling out in the world, it has gotten a little bit tougher. But we keep coming back to science and coming back to evidence and coming back to data. And really, when passionate debates are happening in Washington or in state capitals, we really try to be the grown-ups in the room who come armed with data to support our viewpoints and not really doing it in a partisan way.
Thank goodness for that, given that I'd love to see that all over every institution, but thank goodness for that part. I'd like to kind of just switch the topic just a little, and let's talk about what the AMA does on behalf of patients. So not about the physician, but the patient. So how, I know you gave a very nice list because all those things would touch a patient, but how does the AMA help patients?
At the end of the day, so much of what we do is about making sure that our patients have access to healthcare and that that's high quality healthcare that they have access to. And so that cuts across a lot of our work. If you think about our advocacy agenda, we've worked very hard to make sure that we move towards being a country where every American has access to high quality healthcare, and that means having insurance to be able to use the system. Right. And it needs to be usable insurance with reasonable deductibles and copays. So cost and access, I think, are two big areas that we work on. And then there's so many things that touch on that, right? So thinking about, is it useful for a patient to be able to come see me and have insurance coverage so that they can do that? But then we sit down and talk about a plan for them and what makes the most sense to treat their condition. And then they show up at the pharmacy and that expensive medication is not on their health plan's formulary, and we have to go through days of arguing with a health plan to get what's called prior authorization to get it approved. So there are just multiple things I think that we do, both in terms of access to care, making sure care is affordable, and making sure that the care is high quality. And I think that's sort of at the center of our work for patients. And then again, whether we're thinking about medical education or our advocacy agenda or publishing, really at the end of the day, it's all about advancing that high quality healthcare.
How do you reconcile the AMA is, you know, ultimately, although we are here to help patients, but it's still a physician guild. How does it kind of rectify when the interests sometimes aren't exactly aligned between where the patient needs versus physician interests, if you will? How does it reconcile that?
I'm happy to say that I don't really run into that as a conflict very often. Okay. I mean, at the end of the day, we do represent physicians. And so, for example, we engage on debates in Congress about Medicare payment and making sure that that's adequate so that physicians can run their practices. So we certainly engage on things that are physician-directed and speak up for physicians and what they're facing and the impediments to doing their jobs and burnout that they're facing. But it's always felt to me like at the end of the day, everything we engage on is about making sure that our members have the tools that they need and the resources they need to take care of patients. And I can't really think of the last time where I engaged on an issue where I thought this is good for doctors but bad for patients. It's just not in reality what we tend to run into. I think our interests are quite aligned.
What do you think is the biggest issue? And I know there's always so many, but the biggest issue that are facing patients right now?
I think for patients, I'd put access and costs that we were talking about earlier. Okay. We still have too many people who don't have insurance. We've had huge improvement, or we have patients who have insurance where their deductibles and copays are so large that it's not affordable for them. So that's a big one. I think, you know, a lot of our patients coming back to this era of medicine getting a little bit politicized also are sometimes victims of disinformation. And so a lot of our efforts at the AMA and as individual physicians talking with our patients, a lot of work ends up getting focused on unfortunately, lately having to push back against some of that anti-science aggression and disinformation that people get exposed to in social media and on the web. Those are big issues, I think, that immediately come to mind for my patients.
It's funny you say that, because Lily, right before I came to this interview, I came right from clinic, and I was literally right before the door having to point out that that COVID vaccine did not cause this certain neurological condition. I feel that's all I do every day.
there's a lot of that out there, and it's, you know, I think we see patients who trust us with so many of their major health issues, and then to all of a sudden have these people who've entrusted us to deliver their babies or take care of their neurologic disorders or everything else suddenly put something they've seen on a Facebook group or heard from their Uber driver about the COVID vaccine ahead of what they are learning from their physicians is hard, but that's part of what we do. And so I've just been incredibly proud of my colleagues around the country as I've watched the work that they have done in these difficult couple of years to educate their patients.
What do you think is the biggest issue that physicians are facing right now?
There's just no denying that there's a lot of burnout in the profession. And as I took on this role in June, I really reflected on having come out of these very difficult 2.5 years for the profession. We're fortunately past the time when physicians were having to sleep in tents and garages to protect their family members from COVID infections, or not having enough PPE and masks and having to wear garbage bags to work. But it has been a tough couple of years. And I think a lot of my colleagues are exhausted. And so I look at burnout. I look at 1 in 5 physicians now reporting that they're likely to retire in the next couple of years, which is a frightening statistic. And it really feels like it's time for the nation to renew its commitment back to physicians and make sure that we support doctors so that we have people to take care of us all in the years ahead.
Speaking of burnout, what things are being done? I mean, it seems like it's such a huge issue. It's almost like, where do you begin?
We know and have learned in the last several years that the biggest drivers of burnout are really systemic issues. You know, I went through a time period where initially the health system's response to physician burnout was to help try to make physicians more resilient and offering more free yoga classes or dinner with the hospital CEO or those kind of things. And those are lovely, but that's not the problem. In a way, it almost blames the victim to say, if we can just make you more resilient. The physicians, when we look at those who find joy in their work versus those who are more burnt out, what are the differences we see? The differences are in how many obstacles they feel that get in the way of what drew them to medicine in the first place, which is being able to take great care of patients. So when they work in a system where the average physician is doing 41 of those prior authorizations to fight an insurance company to get a patient the medication they need per week, when they're working with electronic tools that maybe are difficult and weren't designed well for them, all of those things that get in the way of them being able to take good care of patients are really the defining features. So we really do our work at the systemic level, both in terms of big health policy and also working with health systems in various communities. It's been great while I'm here this week, engaging with so many of the hospital systems here in Duval County, to think about how we can better support doctors and get some of those obstacles out of the way.
And to all of our listeners, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Jack Resnick Jr., the president of the American Medical Association. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at Jay Servin. Let's speak about how we got to the burnout, although burnout was already there pre-COVID. It seems like post-COVID seems to be a big element. You know, a lot of medical institutions like the CDC, varying departments of health, they took a big reputational hit during COVID. I'm curious, from your perspective, did the AMA take a reputational hit during COVID, or was it spared? I'm just kind of curious how you view it, given it seems like every other health institution did.
You know, I look at my Twitter feed or my email in basket, and sure, there are people out there who are unhappy with something we've done. But I really believe that if anything, we have advanced the reputation of the medical community of physicians. And we've done that by, from the very early stages of the pandemic, being incredibly consistent and leading with science and leading with evidence and trying to be above the politics of this all. Now, does that sometimes filter in and is it unavoidable? Of course, if we're going to engage on these important issues, you have to get into the space of modern media and the space of social media. But I felt quite good about the way we have handled really sticking with science and evidence.
How did you think that the AMA avoided taking that reputational hit, if you will?
Again, I think it's about an incredible level of consistency and really trying to communicate both in terms of resources that we made available for the profession and for our colleagues and peers, and in terms of how we consistently communicated to the public and tried to rise above some of the political din and the background noise, fighting back against some of the disinformation and anti-science aggression that we were seeing out in the community. It's at the end of the day, one of the things that I have learned during this period is the amount of damage that a really small group of people can do if they're well organized in social media at just monetizing disinformation or spreading things that aren't true about COVID or about vaccine treatment or about anything else related to medicine. But we have gotten much better, I think, at fighting back against some of that disinformation about, you know, really thinking, and we're working on this for the future. How do we help patients and help the public identify what are the red flags to look for disinformation? What are trusted sources they can look to out on the web and in other places?
Do you think the individual physician is still a trusted source overall?
I do. I think it's one of the privileges of being part of this profession, right? When I go to I'm still a practicing physician. I'm on the road a lot these days to the great frustration of some of my patients, but I still go home every week and see patients. And it's just such a privilege that you get to walk into an exam room with patients who come there and entrust you with their health and tell you some, you know, things that they don't tell other people as you work to try to solve their problems together. It's a really, the physician-patient relationship is really special. And I think all of us who practice medicine are in awe of the privilege that the public gives us to be able to sit down together and to have people entrust us with one of the most important things in their lives, their health.
So very true. One of the areas that the AMA does extraordinarily well is its publishing arm. In fact, I have my trusty issue of JAMA right in front of me. It's arguably probably the most important medical journal on the planet. No offense, New England Journal of Medicine. U.S. Surgeon General has said that there's an infodemic, and with the AMAs and the JAMA and all the other journals that are part of it, what are they doing in terms of trying to address this infodemic, which just seems so difficult to get through?
Yeah, I mean, this infodemic really is related to some of the efforts at disinformation that we've seen. I think that has made it harder to advance the health of the nation as we face this. But I just have deep pride in JAMA and the JAMA Network, which is a whole group of journals underneath JAMA for various specialties. We're proud that JAMA is actually completely editorially independent of the AMA. Mm-hmm. So while we own it and fund it and manage it from a business standpoint, we give it complete editorial independence. So they can say bad things about AMA or anything else if they want. And that's what makes it a great journal, because of that editorial independence. And it attracts really many of the best authors in the nation and the world publishing there. We have learned a lot during the pandemic about how do you even, particularly in the midst of a public health crisis, speed up that process.
Right.
So that on the one hand, you're getting important, timely, valuable information out very, very quickly. But on the other hand, you're still keeping those important peer review processes in place that make sure that the information we're putting out is valid and current and appropriate. So I've just watching how well they've done that has been impressive. And another thing is they've gotten way more savvy about utilizing digital and social media as well. And so seeing JAMA's presence so that it can function both as a high-level journal for the profession and has content really aimed at physicians and public health workers and other people in healthcare. But also there, JAMA has learned how to communicate to patients and the public. So there are patient-facing pages that explain different diseases or different things that are going on in the public health. Really important viewpoints and editorials about important policy issues facing the country related to healthcare. So it's a part of the organization I'm just deeply, deeply proud of.
With great reason. To help our listeners out, I bring them up. You just brought it up. Why are peer-reviewed studies, like the one JAMA publishes, more reliable than non-peer-reviewed studies? Maybe I'm asking you to define one versus the other for our listeners, because that seems to be always the crux of what separates a JAMA versus the Twitter feed from our, I'll say, our Uber driver, just even though I'll pay or pick Lyft just to be safe.
Fair enough. So, This is how we in science and healthcare and medicine make each other better and bring out the best in each other. So this is a long tradition of this process in medical publishing, and we see it in other areas of science as well, where somebody does a study and writes it up and sends it into a journal. It's not just about whoever happens to be sitting in the editor seat at that moment making a decision. That article actually goes out to other people with similar expertise, maybe people doing competing work, maybe people doing aligned work in the same area, and comes back with a whole series of criticisms and questions. And sometimes this can go multiple rounds with the authors having to answer those questions, maybe changing their statistical methods or based on suggestions or making sure that their conclusions actually fit with the data that they presented. So it's really a process by which we hold each other to very high standards in medicine before things get published. There have been some changes recently. So there's something called preprint servers, where now articles can actually get put up online before they've even gone through that process. And that's been controversial. It can be helpful in terms of getting new data out quickly, but it has to be presented in the context of the public and the media and others understanding that sometimes things go up on those preprint servers that end up, once they go through the peer review process, not actually getting released, or we find problems with them. So it's important to sort of think of them as in a different category, even if having access to them can be a helpful phenomenon.
Let me switch the topic just a little bit. You know, one of the other things that occurred during the pandemic was that there was a time of the social justice reckoning. And I hate even to bring it up, but I have to. The AMA found itself in some hot water when the JAMA editor made some unfortunate remarks on a podcast, I believe. So I guess my question is, what is the AMA doing to help manage racism?
Well, I'm actually quite glad you brought up issues of racism and health equity, because it's when we as physicians look at data that are very, very clear about health outcomes in this country, we see appalling inequities in outcomes. We see marginalized and minoritized communities who don't have the same health statistics and health outcomes as others. So it's in our lane because it's part of our ethical calling when we see something like that to try to do something about it. You know, you alluded to the AMA's history. We've been around for 175 years. So a piece of our work in the health equity space has just been reckoning with our own history. There have been things we've done in those 175 years as an organization that didn't advance equity or that actually caused harm to marginalized communities. But we're at a point in our history right now where through that reckoning, we are rebuilding trust with those communities and putting a great deal of effort and resources into actually embedding equity and embedding anti-racist work across our organization. And so some people ask me, well, what are you talking about? What does that actually mean? And what does that look like as an organization? And what I try to tell them is I just give examples from across different parts of the organization. So I'll give you a few. I mentioned earlier, we have a litigation center. Mm-hmm. So we looked at the history of tobacco products and noticed a few years ago that, look, the FDA still had not acted to take menthol out of cigarettes. And we know that menthol was added to add addiction, and particularly menthol cigarettes had been targeted to the African-American community, young Black men in particular, with right. devastating health consequences. So the AMA went out and sued the FDA to make them live up to their mandate to get menthol out of cigarettes. And now it looks like that's going to happen. When we think about chronic disease, I mentioned diabetes and hypertension. We're now thinking about what are we doing as a health community that's not succeeding, for example, in dealing with the higher rates of hypertension among Black women in this country? And where do we need to go to make sure that that message gets communicated? When I think about our advocacy unit and what it's doing in Washington, for example, we're focused on making sure that rural communities and other marginalized communities have access to telehealth and telemedicine, and that Medicare doesn't take that away when the pandemic is over. We're thinking about social determinants of health and all of the things that actually affect those inequities that you asked about. So it's an important part of our work, and we're in it for the long haul.
So one of the things to try to address those health inequities is this belief, and I think we'd all agree that it's great to see your physician, your doctor, look like you. So I guess it kind of gets us into the workforce of physicians. Has there been improvement in the number of underrepresented minorities in medicine, and how is the AMA trying to help augment those numbers?
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why it makes good sense to have a physician population that actually resembles the population that we're taking care of. It doesn't mean every visit with every physician or other member of a healthcare team is going to be with somebody who's matched to your own demographics. That obviously doesn't make sense and is not the goal. But it is so important for people to look at our profession and see themselves reflected in it broadly. It's so important in our medical schools for those of us who, as we're training, actually get to learn from the diverse life experiences of different people in our classes. When I look at the current population of physicians, it's about 12% made up of folks who are underrepresented in medicine. When we have a population that's 30%, that's right. A pretty big gap.
It is.
So we're doing a lot to try, and we can't fix that all at the med school level, right? We have to reach further back to help improve the pipeline. So the AMA has a program called Doctors Back to School, where we're actually going to middle schools and high schools around the country and trying to scale that program so that kids and marginalized and minoritized communities actually know that medicine is an option for them. We're supporting historically Black colleges and universities that have medical schools to make sure they have the resources to grow. We're increasing the total number of slots because we know we need a larger physician workforce. We're addressing debt. It obviously affects who can go to medical school.
Yes.
When you have people coming out of medical school with an average of $200,000 in debt that they have to pay back, you know, if you're from a community that doesn't have a lot of resources and a family that can't help you with the cost of medical school, What a huge problem that is.
That's a mortgage. It's crazy when I see it, and it does concern me. And to all of our listeners, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJZT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Jack Resnick Jr., the president of the American Medical Association. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at JServ. I want to switch the topic just a little bit further again. On the issue of politics, again, this is not a political show, but we'll just ask that question. Does the AMA get involved in supporting candidates at the national level, like president, versus at the state level, like governor or senator? And I'm not asking for a declaration of who it's supporting, but does it get involved?
Yeah. So we have a political action committee called AMPAC, also, which is functions independently from the AMA. And it is focused mostly on congressional races and in collaboration with states, actually does support congressional candidates of both parties. It's not a partisan organization. But it supports people who understand healthcare and are interested in improving healthcare and improving healthcare outcomes, and whose work we think is helpful to the mission of advancing health. We don't, as an AMA, tend to get involved in state races. We don't tend to speak on presidential races because we do end up working with the administration, whoever gets elected.
Sure.
Our state medical associations do more often get involved in state races.
Let me also go into another. There's so many issues that seem to be hot button points that medicine touches. Let's talk about Dobbs versus Jackson for a moment. Women now account for almost 30%, well, 36% of doctors in the United States. And it's clear that this decision has had a chilling effect on all women. Where does the AMA stand on the Dobbs versus Jackson decision, and what's its next steps as it deals with this?
So I mentioned earlier that our policy gets made by this diverse group of what we call the House of Delegates that comes together to debate issues. And again, it's doctors from red states and blue states and with a diversity of political views. But our House of Delegates has decided overwhelmingly that access to reproductive health care, and that includes contraception and IVF and abortion, really is an issue that is to be decided between individual patients and their physicians. And we oppose politicians criminalizing what we consider to be basic health care and really inserting themselves into the exam room. So we actually briefed in the Dobbs case. And we're incredibly disappointed and frustrated with the decision. And we know we have physicians, just as you have listeners, who bring individual values and viewpoints to this. But as an organization, our policy is that patients should have access to abortion. And what we are seeing in some of the restrictive states in the wake of Dobbs has been a lot of chaos. So let's talk a little bit about sort of medically indicated abortions. Your listeners may have heard about when you have what's called an ectopic pregnancy,
right,
that implants not in the uterus, but in a fallopian tube or somewhere else where it actually cannot lead to a successful pregnancy and really threatens the health of the pregnant person and has to be treated. Or miscarriages that have not completed on their own and where a patient can get a complication from a miscarriage, such as sepsis, which is a bloodstream infection, or hemorrhage, where they're bleeding. And you really have to intervene to protect the life of the mother in these situations. What we're seeing in states is where emergency physicians and others are literally having to call hospital attorneys.
Wow.
Because they are facing a web of new laws, a web of reactivated laws from the 1800s in some cases, that are conflicting and restrictive and confusing. And so rather than urgently taking care of the patient in front of you, physicians are having to call the hospital lawyers and say things like, well, I think this patient has a 20% chance of death if I don't intervene. And hearing things back like, well, under the current law, until that gets to 50%, we think you can't take care of this patient. And so we're just deeply, deeply troubled. And these are not rare instances. This happens every day in hospitals across the country in these states with restrictions. Ectopics are about 1% to 2% of all pregnancies. Miscarriages, who among us doesn't have a colleague or a friend or a family member who's been through that? So you asked about our work. We obviously initially were very engaged in the courts around this issue. There's somewhat less possibility of that on the larger issue related to Dobbs now. But we're doing a lot to try to mitigate some of the health concerns for our patients and our physician members' ability to take care of them. There's a law in place that's been around a long time called EMTALA.
Yes.
And for listeners who don't know about EMTALA, it basically was created many years ago to say, hey, if you show up in an emergency department and you're dying or are gravely ill or unstable, regardless of your insurance or anything else, the physician in the emergency department and the hospital have to take care of you. And so there's litigation going on right now in Texas and Idaho and a couple of other places where the federal government has said, hey, this really applies also to a pregnant patient who's having an ectopic or a complicated miscarriage, that you're obligated to take care of them. And we have a couple of states who are suing back and saying, no, physicians are not obligated to take care of these patients. They have to follow our new restrictive laws instead. So that's one area where we're engaging. Another is we have patients who aren't pregnant and where abortion itself really isn't the issue at all, but they're taking a medication, there are many of them, that happen to either lead to birth defects or also sometimes be used in something like an ectopic. There's a drug called methotrexate. We use it to treat lupus, sure, arthritis, psoriasis, some cancers, all kinds of different things. And patients are literally showing up at pharmacies in some of these states and now being told that they cannot have their methotrexate filled because the pharmacist is nervous that maybe it's being used for an abortion instead. And so this is affecting people way beyond those who are pregnant or those who are seeking abortions. We're thinking about medical education. We're thinking about we're going to have a generation of medical students and residents trained in some of these states who won't even get exposure to how to handle basic miscarriage management and that kind of thing. So there are a lot of fronts. We have not yet seen all the consequences of this, but we are out there standing up for physicians and standing up for patients.
Let me switch the topic to a slightly different thing, which is the future, which is always, I'm the optimist and I assume we all are, but let's kind of get some potential topics here. So many patients don't have access. You talked about that's one of the big roles. We need to get access to healthcare because of lack of insurance. And I guess my question is, does the AMA envision a U.S. with a single payer system, not Medicare as we have it with older adults, but a single payer system for everyone?
Well, let me back up a second and first say that our values at the AMA, again, are that everybody in America should have access to healthcare. Right. And having access to healthcare means having affordable insurance. So we feel very strongly about that. And that's why we supported the ACA, because it was a big step in reducing the number of uninsured, and that has given us a lot of progress. And we think we can build on that and continue to improve that. At the end of the day, our policy is not in support of a single payer system. Sure. We think we can do this with a diversity of payers. We have some anxiety about, we've talked a little bit about some of the political controversies in the country and dysfunction in Congress. Having the U.S. Senate responsible for all of healthcare in the country gives me some anxiety. But we're still very, very strong advocates for making sure everybody in this country has access to affordable healthcare.
Fair enough. Minnesota made headlines when its nurses went on a strike. I have also understood that some medical residents have also talked about unionization. So my question is, do you foresee physicians unionizing a la nurses or pilots?
So we actually have policy at the AMA that supports physicians' right to collective bargaining. And I think as we've seen more consolidation in healthcare, private equity firms moving in and buying up hospitals or practices, you know, the level of burnout that we talked about earlier, physicians need to have a stronger voice in being able to advocate for what they need to take good care of their patients. So we do support their ability to collective bargain. You know, there are some caveats. We're a little bit different than some other groups that might unionize or bargain collectively. We wouldn't support, for example, a total physician walkout in a community that leaves patients sitting in intensive care units uncared for. So I mean, we think there are ways for physicians who are collectively bargaining to have their voice heard, maybe without doing that, because at the end of the day, we are so driven by our ethics and our values that brought us to this profession that we don't see that as a means to the ends that we're looking for. But we think collective bargaining is an important piece of this for physicians. For those physicians and physicians in those communities who see that as a way to move ahead and want to, and choose to do that.
One other future topic is AI. I know you brought that up earlier. There was a very interesting study a few years back that was published, done by a Chinese group, where they used an AI methodology to look at the correct diagnosis from their med students and residents and staff versus an AI, just by looking at the language of the history and physical. And I guess, fortunately, physicians still won over the AI machine. But my question to you is, do you see AI as replacing physicians, or do you see it as a complement? Because I guess I always worry, is tech going to disrupt the healthcare industry like it has so many other areas like publishing or something like that?
You know, physicians have always been supporters of and excited about innovation. When you think about all the changes we've seen in medicine over the last century, it's exciting. And I think physicians are largely excited about AI. We tend to call it augmented intelligence instead of artificial intelligence, just to drive home the point that I think it's at its best when it's a tool that we can deploy to help us with what we do. And if there are things that it turns out doing better than I can, amen. I'm all for utilizing those parts of AI in my practice. I don't see that as a threat, and I don't think physicians do in general. What we are talking a lot about, though, is while we think AI will be incredibly helpful, making sure that at the front end, as we develop these technologies, we think about some really important questions, because there are going to be a lot of them out there. And we ask some of the same questions we would ask of a drug or a device or anything else that's an innovation in healthcare. First of all, does it work? Has it actually been rigorously tested in a way that it does what it says it does and is not just all about a lot of hype? And we've seen examples in AI where they haven't always done the thing. Secondly, does it actually advance healthcare for patients? Does it work in our offices? Is it usable? Is it user-friendly? Does it fix something that actually matters to our patients, or is it just a cool gadget? And then there are questions about how it's going to be paid for, or the sort of who's going to be responsible if it goes awry, and how do we make sure that we keep patients' privacy protected in the midst of developing AI? So how do we make sure that it gets deployed in ways that advance health equity rather than making things worse? And some of the things that happen with AI technology, so you mentioned I'm a dermatologist. So I think there'll be incredibly useful AI tools that will help me look at a mole on somebody's skin, right? This is sort of low-hanging fruit for AI and say, yep, this one needs a biopsy, or this one's fine. And machines can actually learn from images and help us with that predictive capacity. But it's all about the images that you choose to feed the AI tool that it learns from. Right. And thinking about, there was a study somebody did. I'll just give you this one example, a little bit of a story. So there are some tools out there that are already trying to help do this. And some of them have been studied and actually looked pretty good in the studies and had been shown to be helpful. And one of these that was deployed, somebody asked an interesting question as a researcher later, and they got suspicious. It turns out that, and this is a system that's trying to identify things that are suspicious for melanoma, which is a life-threatening skin cancer, usually a dark, irregular black mole, from moles that might be a little weird looking and tempting to biopsy, but would turn out to be benign and harmless. It turns out that the set of photos that were fed to this machine to teach it to tell the difference, the melanomas that it got were melanomas that doctors were just about to do surgery on. And so they had what we call surgical markings on the photographs. They were very likely to have the surgeon where they drew out on the person's skin exactly where they were going to cut and how they were going to reassemble the person and sew them up. And the pictures of the benign lesions didn't have surgical markings because they were just random moles that were getting biopsied to create this tool. So sorry if this is a little hard to follow, but basically somebody decided to test this machine by feeding it the exact same mole with and without surgical markings. Mm. And it turned out that the AI tool had learned that surgical markings were predictive of melanoma. And so if you submitted the same mole with and without, you'd get actually different results. So it's going to take a lot of smart people asking really hard questions, even with tools that look cool and that eventually are going to be incredibly helpful about, okay, have we done something wrong along the way? Because it's very hard to learn why an AI tool is telling you to do X or Y as opposed to A or B. So a lot of work still needs to be done in this space. But the bottom line is we're excited, and we do think it's going to improve healthcare eventually.
As we kind of get into our final moments with you, there's so many issues. We could probably spend another hour and we'd have more than enough discussion. But what issue keeps you up at night the most these days that you're saying, my goodness, I during the time I'm president, this is the thing I want to really leave a mark on for all of us?
What keeps me up at night? This is a hard question. What keeps me up at night is the fact that I don't even know from day to day what the issues are going to be. And if there's one thing I've learned in medical leadership roles over the last couple of decades, and the privilege to serve in roles like this one as president of the AMA, it's that we can't know what's in the year ahead or my year as presidency, who would have envisioned the COVID pandemic and all that it has done, or some of the stuff we've seen in politicization of healthcare. But if you push me to say, is there one thing that's worrying me? I do think I just can't help but be worried about the level of burnout I see in my colleagues around the country. And, yeah. and as you said earlier, I'm an optimist, as you are. And I think we're going to turn a corner and we're going to do what it takes as a country to support physicians and support healthcare so that we can in turn take great care of our patients. But we have some work to do to get those obstacles and dysfunction in healthcare out of the way so that patients and physicians can work together to advance health. So I think that's probably at the top.
Well, I'm going to leave it with that. At least I'm sure that if we ever get you back here, there'll probably be a whole other slew of questions. But I just want to thank you, Dr. Resnick, for you joining us today and for all your wisdom, advice, and perspective. This has been a true honor for me and I know for our listeners just to have you be able to talk about all these topics with us that are so important and near and dear to all of our hearts on an everyday basis.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's actually been an honor to be here and to get to speak with your listeners. And thank you for putting on this show and shining a spotlight on so many important health issues.
Well, it's been a true honor. We've been talking to Dr. Jack Resnick Jr. He is president of the American Medical Association. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to Dr. Jack Resnick Jr. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Isabella Da Silva is our director. Next week's program is about healthcare at 30,000 feet in the air. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, emailing us at health@wjct.org, or tweeting me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do With It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.